This continues, lest it come to scandal, the genesis of Jewish kingship, from Lot and his daughters to Judah and Tamar and the Book of Ruth. This is the fifth tape in the series. Before we begin, just a note for those of you listening on tape. I want to mention that the current class will, among other things, further develop our understanding of the section of Deuteronomy we dealt with earlier, having to do with a man who marries two wives. Please be aware, though, that this lecture was recorded before an audience that has not yet heard any treatment of that particular topic. Therefore, when we do get to that section, it's going to be introduced as if the listener was not yet already familiar with it. I hope you enjoy the lecture. Today what I'd like to do is see if we can finish up the story of Judah and Tamar, the story of Yehuda and Tamar. We had spent a fair amount of our time over the last 2 weeks searching for connections between the apparently out-of-place story of Judah and Tamar and the other stories that appear in chapter 37 and 39 and the surrounding area, somehow seeking a way to relate the story of Joseph and his brothers, which is the surrounding context, to the apparent interruption, the story of Judah and Tamar, which appears in chapter 38. Last week, we had noted a number of connections between the stories. I'd like to see if we can tie together those connections and understand their meaning today. So we had mentioned a number of things. We had mentioned that really almost every element, almost every striking visual element that appears in chapter 38, the story of Judah and Tamar, somehow has its expression in the story of Joseph and his brothers in one way or another. We talked about the goats and the coats last week, that we have a goat in the story of chapter 38, we have goats in 37, we have coats in each chapter. We talked about the collateral, didn't we? And the collateral that appears in this, the Eravon that appears in chapter 38. And we talked about the collateral that appears later on in the story of Joseph and his brothers, the collateral when Judah pledges himself as collateral for Benjamin. We talked about the train of recognition, did we not? The notion of the words v'lo hikiruhu, which first appear in the story of the deception of Isaac by Jacob, when Jacob deceives his father as to who his firstborn son is. So the words that are used are v'lo hikiruhu, that he did not recognize him, and that begins a train of the use of the word hakerna. And we talked about this, did we not, last week, right? We talked about that the brothers, led by Judah, the word that they choose to use when confronting Jacob with the bloody coat is hakerna haketonet bin chahi imla. We actually noted that it was actually a longer phrase. It was zot matzanu, this we have found, hakerna, do you recognize it? In those words, hakerna, are echoing the words of Jacob's own deception of his father. And again, those words get echoed once more when Tamar presents Judah with another coat and says those very same words. Well, he mutzeit, she is being taken out. We talked about that being similar to matzah, the taking out, similar to finding. Here, what Judah was looking for was right under his nose, Tamar, but she was being taken out. Taking out is the opposite of finding. Finding is when I take something in. Taking out is when I bring it out. So there's a play on the words of Zot Matsanu, this we have found. Now she is being taken out, and she uses those same words, Hakerna. Zot Matsanu Hakerna, ki mutzeit Hakerna. As she was being taken out, she again presents the cloak and says, will you recognize it? I want to elaborate a little bit on this parallel before we go on to some of the others, which is that we say that the train of recognition begins in the story of Jacob's deception of Isaac, when Jacob deceives his father about who the firstborn son is, and v'lo hikiruhu, and there's a goat and a coat, a goat which is killed and and is presented to Jacob as if it were game, and there is coats, the coats of Esau, which are placed upon the hands of Yaakov to make him feel more like Esau, v'lo hikiru, and he didn't recognize it. So he said that those elements appear also when the brothers deceive their own father, when they deceive Jacob, where again we have a goat that is slaughtered, and the blood of that goat goes upon the coat, and again we have hakerna, do you recognize it? There, though, is another angle in which those words are echoed one more time in the Torah, and that last echo of those words, I think, throws a radically interesting light upon the meaning of all of this as well. I'd like to introduce you to one more time where we find the words hakara, recognition, where we find the words matzah, finding, and where all of this seems to be echoed one more time. It's in a very unlikely place. In Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 15, we have a surprising paragraph. Here's what it says. The verse says the following. Okay, I want to ask you what this reminds me of. Ki tiena le'ish. The Bible tells us, ki tiena le'ish, when a man, as of course in those days polygamy was allowed, a man could marry two women. Ki tiena le'ish, when a man will have shtei nashim, two wives. Ha'achat ahuva v'achat tznua. One of them he loves, and the other of whom he despises or he doesn't like as much. Now, what are we talking about here? We're talking about a man who has two wives, one of whom he favors. Now you could say, okay, we're just talking about something. But listen to the words here. Achat ahuva v'achat tznua. One of them is tznua. For those of you who have your ears attuned to this kind of thing, and if you ask yourself, where else in the Torah do we have a woman who is known as a tznua? Not a Leah. Isn't that interesting? How is Leah described? She's the only woman in Tanakh who is described as Sinua. That Leah says, she says, God has seen that I am hated or that I'm not as loved as my rival wife, my sister. So Leah sees herself as Sinua. And here the Torah harks back to the only woman that is ever known as Sinua, apparently an oblique reference to Leah. So, ki tiena le'ish, when there will be to a man two wives. So what man would we be talking about if the Sinua is Leah?
Jacob,
right? So Jacob is the model. When a man has two wives, one of whom he loves, who's that? Rachel. One of whom he doesn't love quite as much. She's the Sinua. Who would that be? Leah. The Yaldu lo banim ha'uvava Sinua. And those two wives have children. The loved wife and the wife that is not loved quite as much. Vaya b'chana ben ha'bechor. It will happen that the firstborn son, to which wife? To the sniya, to the wife which is not as loved as much, as indeed, who was the firstborn son in that marriage? It was Reuven, the child of Leah. So you have a firstborn son to the wife who is not quite as much loved. Vahaya, it shall be, biyom hanchilo et banav, in the day that he decides to give his children his inheritance, to disperse his estate, et asher yelo, when he gives his estate up, lo yuchal levaker et ben ahuva al pnei ben asnua habachor. He must not, he is unable, he is prescribed by Torah law, from making the child of the loved wife his firstborn over the child of the wife that he does not favor quite as much. Rather, ki, et habachor ben hasnua yakir. He must instead, yakir, recognize the child of, listen to that word, he must recognize, yakir, hakerna, he must recognize the child of the sinua, of the wife which is not as much loved. And it's a strange language, by the way. Latet lo pishnayim, to give him a double portion, b'chol asher yimotze lo, with everything that is found to him in his estate. Ki hu reshita no, because he is the first child that he has, the first of his strength, literally, lo mishpat abachora, to him is the mishpat of the firstborn. Now, listen to this for a moment. Listen to these words very carefully in one sentence. The words are strange. If I would want to say that I would have to give a double portion to a firstborn, what would I say? I would say, the Bechor ben Absnua, the child of the hated wife, I have to give him more in all of my estate. But if you look at the verbs here, they are not that. What is the verb used to describe the giving of the double portion to the firstborn? It is a strange verb indeed. It is recognition. Ki et habchor ben asnua yakir, you must recognize him. And what is the word for estate? Not the normal word for estate. It is rather instead, latet lo pishnayim, you must give him a double portion, b'chol asher yimatze lo. Translate those words. B'chol asher yimatze lo. In all that is found to him. What a strange language for an estate. One more time, recognition and finding. What does this remind you, folks? Zot matzanu. This we have found. Hakerna. Recognize, please. Is it your child's coat or not? To me, Devarim, this passage in Devarim gives a chilling, radically different understanding of those words back in Genesis. If you look at Devarim being modeled after Genesis, all of the words from Devarim come from Genesis, by the way, even Reshit Ono. Where do those words come from? Ki hu reishit ono. Because that firstborn child, he is reishit ono. He is the first of your issue. Where do those words come from? That's also a quote from Genesis. The first of your strength. Who says reishit ono? Yaakov. And when does he say it? When he blesses them. And who does he say it to? Reuven, his oldest son. When finally, at the end of the story, he calls Reuven reishit ono. But actually, there was another child who has a name very similar to reishit ono. Who is that? What other one of Jacob's children has a name that is similar to reishit ono, the first of your strength? It is Binyamin. Actually, not his oldest child, but his youngest child. And who is Binyamin the child of? Rachel. Binyamin is born. Okay? What's the scene? Rachel is dying in childbirth. Rachel names the child. What does she name him? She names the child Ben-Oni. What does Ben-Oni mean? Now, Oni could mean two things. What Rachel means when she says Ben-Oni is that she is, this is the child of my own, my suffering. Oni means suffering, because she was dying in childbirth. She names him Ben-Oni. But that's not what Jacob calls him. Jacob changed the name from Ben-Oni to something else. What does Jacob call the child? Binyamin. Now, why does he change Ben-Oni to Binyamin? What's the connection between Ben-Yamin, the son of my right hand, to Ben-Oni, the son of my suffering? How did he go from the son of my suffering that Rachel called him to Ben-Yamin? So the Ketav Kabbalah asks this question, and he suggests that Ben-Oni can mean two things. On can mean not just suffering, but it could also mean strength. On could also mean strength. And what Yaakov said is, yes, he is Ben-Oni. Right? He's not just the child of your suffering. He's Ben-Oni. He's also the child of my strength, i.e., he's like my firstborn child. He's so dear to me, he's like my firstborn child. So therefore, I name him Ben-Yamin, the child of my right hand, because he's my right-hand man. He's my Bechor. He's my strength, the child of my strength. But he wasn't. He was his last child. He wasn't his first child. But for him, no. It was one of the two precious children he had from Rachel, from the wife that was really meant to be his wife, from his wife that he saw as his main wife, and therefore he named him Ben-Yamin. And his wife that died and named him suffering, he changed the name and said, no, you are my right-hand child. Ben-Oni. So what happens? Yaakov, throughout his life, what has he done? He started it with his own father, and it happens again with his children. It's the changing of who is the firstborn. He himself was the younger child, right? And what does he do? His father wants us to bless the older child, but he deceives his father, and he blesses him instead. What does he do with his own sons? Why was he giving Yosef this beautiful coat? What was he really saying about Yosef? Why was Yosef so special? Who was Yosef? He was Rachel's son. Not just Rachel's any old son, but who was he? Rachel's firstborn son. So what did Yaakov think of him? He said, you want to know who my firstborn is? My firstborn is him. He is my firstborn. He's Rachel's firstborn, so he is my firstborn. So he shows favoritism to Yosef to make him the firstborn son. And to show it, he gives a coat. Now, what happens? What happens is the brothers look at that and they become jealous of Yosef. Because they say, Dad loves Yosef more than he loves us. V'lo yachlu davar lo shalom. They couldn't speak to him because they were so upset about it, right? So what do they then do? The brothers take that coat, and what do? They strip him of that coat, and they put goat's blood on that coat, and they send it to the father, and they say, Zot matzanu, this we have found, hakerna, whoa, there go my nuts, hakerna, can you recognize, please, haktonet bincha hi imlo. Now listen to that with the echoes of Deuteronomy in your mind. Remember how Deuteronomy uses that language? What must a man do? A man must... Et ha-bechor ben ha-snua yakir. You must recognize who your real firstborn is. It's the child of the wife that you don't love as much. You have to recognize that painful truth and give him double portion b'chol asher yimatzei lo. In all of your estate, what's your estate? That which is found to you. Now listen to what the brothers say. The brothers take this coat and they present it with goat's blood on it to the father. And they say, Zot matzanu. Here, this we have found. According to Deuteronomy, what does that mean, this we have found? What is the word found for? It's a word for your estate. This is your stuff. Zot matzonu, here it is. This is your estate. We found this, right? Hakerna. What are they saying? Recognize, please. What are they asking their father to do? Haktonet bin chahim lo. Does this belong to Joseph or not? What are they really saying? Does this really belong to him? You're treating him as a firstborn. You're giving him this double portion. It doesn't belong to him. There's another firstborn. It's not him. Haktonet bincha hi imlo. There's another meaning to those words. It's not just, is it Joseph's coat? Is he dead? It's, does it really belong to this child or not? Haktonet bincha hi. Is it the coat of your child, of the child that you want it to be, or not? Or is it someone else's coat? There's a cry of pain coming from the brothers, which is that you don't know who the firstborn in your family is. You're illegitimately favoring one over the other. And Deuteronomy echoes this. And it says, never again are we going to get stuck in this mistake. When a man has two wives, achat ahuva v'achat tznua, one loved and one hated, and there's children from both, you can't do that. You have to recognize the painful truth that your bechor is your bechor, even if he doesn't come from the wife that you love most. And you have to recognize him to give him the double portion of everything that belongs in your state. Why? Ki hu reishito no. Because it's not Binyamin, right, who is the Ben Oni, who is the child of your strength, who's your youngest child. Hu reishito no. It's your oldest child that's the child of your strength. And in fact, Yaakov at the end of his life recognizes it, and in the final brachas on his deathbed says to Reuven, you are kochi v'reshit oni, you are my strength, and you are these words from Deuteronomy, reshit oni, the first of my strength. When he finally recognizes that Reuven really is the Bechor, but it causes much pain until we finally get there. So this is where the brothers are coming from. So coming back to the first deception, hold on. Deception number one involving Hakara, involving recognition, is the deception of Yaakov when he deceives Yitzchak. What is that deception about? It's about who the firstborn son is. What is the medium for that deception? The medium for the deception is goats and coats. And what happens? The brothers then deceive their own father about who the real firstborn is, trying to undo what they see as the mistake that their father has done. They're trying to show him who the real Bechor is. So they too use goats and coats. And they too use the medium of recognition. And Deuteronomy echoes their words and they says, you can't make him the firstborn. Just as the father was deceived about who the firstborn is, now they are going to deceive him about who the firstborn is. Nevertheless, as justified perhaps as the complaint of the brothers was, what they did was corrupt. Because as angry as you are at Yosef, and as upset you are as a family dynamics, you can't go killing your brother, and you can't even go taking your brother and selling him into slavery. You've got to find another way. And that was the position that Judah was put in at this time. What Judah had was a fateful decision in front of him. What am I going to do in this situation? How am I going to deal with this situation? What do I do? And you have Judah and you have Reuven. You have Reuven, the natural firstborn, and you have Yehuda, who really steps up to the plate and acts like a leader. Reuven does is he forfeits his power really of persuasion, and he tries to make an end run around the problem, say, look, let's kill him, let's put him in the pit, but I'll come back at night and take him out. Reuven does not act as a leader here, although he acts with a great amount of moral capacity. Yehuda steps up and asks by a leader. Through the sheer force of his personality and charisma and his moral vision, he says, we can't do it. It's wrong. Achinu b'sarenuhu, he's our brother, we can't kill him. But Yehuda fails to go all the way. And from here, we get into his exact failure. And here I'd like to get to Rashi. I think we touched upon this last week. We talked about this Rashi last week, did we not? The Rashi that links the story of chapter 38 to 39. Rashi's view of how the story of Yehuda and Tamar is connected to its surrounding chapters is the following. Rashi says that when the brothers saw the pain and anguish, the unexpected pain and anguish which their father had as the result of the demise, the quasi-death of their first child that he could never get over with, when he said, "Ki ered al bni avel sheola," I will go down to my grave mourning my son, when he said those words, the brothers responded by saying, "Dad said he'll go down to his grave mourning his son." The first words of this chapter are, "Vayered Yehuda meit echav." Judah went down from amongst his brothers. Zuck Rashi. Rashi says, what does that mean? It means that the brothers looked at the father's language. You're going down to your grave mourning forever. What a cataclysmic mistake we did. Therefore, Judah can no longer be king over us. We are causing him to descend from his position of political power over us because he failed us as king. We mentioned before that at face value, Rashi seems to only explain a very small thing. He seems to only explain not what chapter 38 as a whole is doing here, but what the first verse of chapter 38 is doing here. That at most, Rashi explains to us only why we have verse 1, but not the surrounding chapter. In other words, it would be enough, one might think, if Rashi is correct, to say that there was a story of the sale of Joseph. Afterwards, Judah went down from amongst his brothers. And meanwhile, let's get back to Joseph. What do I need the whole story of Judah and Tamar for? It's my thesis that Rashi is not just talking about the first verse of chapter 38, but he's talking about all of chapter 38. What Rashi is really saying is that the sale of Joseph had ramifications that went beyond just Joseph. Part of the sale of Joseph were ramifications for Joseph. Joseph goes down to Egypt, and we'll get back to that story. But there were other ramifications in the family for the story of Joseph. The other ramifications were with reference to Judah and Judah's leadership. As a result of Judah's failure to stand up in this position of leadership, Judah went down from amongst his brothers, and what I'm going to argue is that all of chapter 38 is about, can Judah rebound from that? Is it possible for Judah to come back from this setback? What will be with Judah's leadership? And ultimately, will there be such a thing as the Davidic dynasty? Because if Judah can't come back from it, there's no King David. If there's no way to rebound from this situation, Judah forfeits his right to lead, and there is no such thing as a line of Davidic kings that comes from Judah. What is at stake is nothing less than the future of the Messiah, of the future of Jewish kingship as it presently stands. And that is what is being worked out in chapter 38. What are the ramifications of the sale of Joseph for Judah? It's appropriate at this point, I think, to stop for a moment and to ask ourselves this question. If we would have to isolate and understand and sort of dissect Judah's failure as a leader in this story, what exactly is this failure all about? In what ways did he fail? Let me ask you the following thing. A while back, there was such a thing known as the Schlesinger poll of presidents. What they have is a bunch of historians get together and they rate the presidents every once in a while on a rating from 1 to 4, with 4, I think, being the highest and 1 being the lowest, on a number of different things. Now, what do you need to be a great president? So you need a bunch of different things. You need maybe great power, great charisma, great vision, moral clarity, all of those things, right? Maybe you also need to live in momentous times. I think Clinton once complained at the very beginning of his presidency that the reason why he can't be a 4 is because he doesn't live in momentous enough times. If only he lived some great crisis and he could be a 4, but he doesn't have a shot at it, so the best he can hope for is a high 3. Right? So that was his view of things. So, but what I'm interested in, though, is not so much what makes you a 4 or a 3, but how do you avoid being a 1? Okay? In other words, how do you avoid being like a really lousy leader? What are the things that you need to do that is just to avoid just the possibility that your term as leader will be completely torpedoed? Okay? I mean, what do you have to do? What are the things that contribute to being just a completely lousy leader? So let me just throw that question at you. What?
Criminal activity.
Okay, criminal activity. Now, I'm going to argue that criminal activity is bad, right? But criminal activity alone is not necessarily enough to seal your fate. Because it's got to be high crimes and misdemeanors, right? What happens if you don't have high crimes and misdemeanors? What happens if you just have crimes and misdemeanors, right? So then technically you can't be impeached. But you can still do something bad enough to get to completely torpedo your presidency when you're guilty of crimes and misdemeanors, which is what?
Deny them.
If you commit crimes and misdemeanors and you deny them or attempt to cover them up, that is the one thing that can completely torpedo you, because even though your crimes themselves might not rise to the level of impeachable offenses, but your cover-up and your embarrassment and your response to those crimes might be enough to completely torpedo you. Witness the Clinton presidency. Witness even Nixon. Because the break-in in the Watergate Hotel, you could argue whether that was high crimes and misdemeanors, but the obstruction of justice is for sure high crimes and misdemeanors. And what got Nixon was the obstruction of justice more than the break-in. And what got Clinton was the lying. It wasn't really the issue of what it was in the first place. It was, are you lying and are you obstructing justice? That really is always the issue. So one thing which will get you as a leader is the following thing. If you want to be a good leader, you can't say, you know how I'm going to be a good leader? I'm going to have a scandal-free presidency. Clinton, by the way, said this, right, in his first days in office. He says, we're going to have a scandal-free presidency. So you can't say that you're going to have a scandal-free presidency because, look, scandals happen, okay? What you need to do is you have to have a way of dealing with scandal. I mean, how are you going to deal with scandal when it happens? And that is what separates the men from the boys, as it were, right? That, in other words, when scandal happens, you now have a choice. If you have the moral clarity to see that something has gone wrong, you now have a very terrible choice to make. You standing upon this precipice, when that your stomach drops, when you see that pit in your stomach grows, you realize that, oh my goodness, look what has happened, this is really lousy. You then can do two things. One thing you can do is you can shrink away from the very scary possibility of this all and pretend that maybe it'll just go away if you hide. That will inexorably lead you down the road of cover-up. It will inexorably lead you, you can deny it, you can not deal with it, you can shrink away from the challenge which awaits you, or you can face the challenge. Facing the challenge means that you've got to find some way to short-circuit the rise of this mistake. It means having the courage to stand up and basically recognize the error. You've got to be able to stand up and say, this is what happened, it was wrong, I'm responsible for it, here's what happened, these are the details, it was terrible, let's try and go on. If you can do that, you've got a fighting chance. But if you can't do that, if you take the easy way out, if you have the moral clarity to understand that what was happening is wrong, but you don't put an end to it, what happens is it snowballs. It just gets larger and larger, and your next chance to rectify the mistakes are when the snowball is much bigger than it was, and pretty soon the snowball will consume you. So that's one thing you need to do, which is that if you're going to avoid being a lousy leader, you've got to be able to somehow have some sort of mechanism to nip mistakes at their bud. I think there's another aspect, though, of things you need to do in order to avoid being a lousy leader. And that is, think back to John F. Kennedy, for example. John F. Kennedy was significant because he was the first Catholic ever elected president, right? What would have happened to Kennedy if he gave huge subsidies to Catholic schools in the third day of his presidency? It would have completely torpedoed his presidency. What would people have said? They would have said, in a Protestant nation, he is not a leader of the nation. He is a leader of his own interest groups, the Catholics. In other words, what is it that makes a leader a leader? Then this cuts to the very definition, by the way, of leadership. What is it that makes someone a leader? What defines the difference between a private citizen and a leader? What defines the difference is that as a private citizen, you have private concerns. You're concerned with your own little world. A leader is not concerned with his own little world. He is concerned with the community as a whole. He almost has to forfeit his little world. It's a terrible thing. And if we think about it also with Lieberman trying for the presidency, what would it look like to have an Orthodox Jew in the... Could an Orthodox Jew really deal with Israel with integrity and fulfill his obligations as Jew and as president? It's a very chilling question. But what does it mean to be a leader? To be a leader means to really have no personal concerns, to have your policy guided only by the good of that community. It's an interesting chazal. The sages say in the Talmud that av shemachal al kvodo, kvodo macho, melech shemachal al kvodo, ein kvodo macho. If your child asks you, Mommy, can I sit in your chair? Is it okay if I sit in your chair? So you know that children aren't supposed to sit in the chairs of their parents. But if a child says, Mommy, can I sit in your chair? Are you allowed to say yes, or must you say no? The rule is you can say yes. You can say it's okay if you sit in my chair. Why? Because a parent that is mochel on their kavod, a parent that waives their honor, has the right to waive their honor. Why is it that a parent has a right to waive their honor? Because where does a parent's honor come from? It comes from the fact that they created the child. That they created the child. So you created the child. You can waive the honor that comes from creating that child. You're the balabas over that honor. It's yours. But a king cannot waive his honor. If a king says, don't roll out the red carpet from me and hold the Star-Spangled Banner this time, and we don't need the 21-gun salute, you can't listen to him. You have to do it anyway. Why? He says he doesn't need it. He's such a humble guy. The answer is because it's not his honor. Where does it come from? It doesn't come from anything he did. It's an expression of the community. He represents the community. He's not a private individual. You're not honoring him as private individual. It's not his. You're honoring the community by honoring him. He represents the community. So what is the worst thing that a president could do? The worst thing that a leader could do would be as leader to lead only your clique. Right? If I show that as leader I have private concerns and I show favoritism towards my clique and not to the nation as a whole, then I'm sunk. If we were to analyze what Judah did wrong, Judah failed here in these two crucial tests of leadership. What happened? Everyone was mad at Joseph, perhaps justifiably so. They see him coming. They plot to kill him. Now, if Judah was swept away in the moment and couldn't see it, it would be one thing. But he's not swept away. He understands it's wrong. Not only does he understand it's wrong, he has the moral clarity and vision to stand up and courage to stand up and say it's wrong. And he has the persuasion and the power to say it's wrong. And they listen to him. They are persuaded by him. But there's a terrible, terrible, tragic mistake that happens, which is that he doesn't go far enough. Because he says, let's not kill him. After all, he is our brother. Let's sell him into slavery instead. That doesn't make any sense. If you have the moral clarity to know that you can't kill him because he's your brother, you also have the moral clarity to know you can't sell him as a slave because he's your brother either. Nevertheless, he's not able to make that jump. What happens is that he sees a mistake happening before him, but he doesn't stem the tide. He is afraid to use his power to its fullest extent. He allows the mistake to snowball. He sees a mistake, and instead of taking the harsh decision to nip it in the bud and say, we've got to return him to dad, as painful as that is, that's too hard for him to do, so he stops it. He allows the mistake to fester and to grow larger. That is one problem. That is one tragic flaw in his leadership. The other tragic flaw in his leadership is that who is Judah and where does he come from? He comes from Leah. Who is he siding with? He's siding with the children of Leah against a rival child, the child of Rachel. He's siding with somebody from his own side of the family. He is a leader not of the entire nation right now. He's the leader of his clique. And the brothers see both of those things and says that by Yered Yehuda Meit Echad, you are going to go down from your position of leadership from us because you could have stopped this and you didn't. When you said, let's not kill him, Hayinu Shomim Lach, we were listening to you. We listened to you. You had the power. You could have gone further. Ata Marta Lamachro, you were the ones who told us to sell him into slavery. Ilu Amarta Lashivo, if you had told us to return him to dad, we would have listened to you and you didn't. You failed to execute your power as you should have. You no longer can be leader. What I would like to suggest is that the entire story of Judah and Tamar is now the story of can Yehuda climb back from that or not. And I'd like to take a few moments now to read through the story and see how the story progresses on those grounds. Vayhi ba'itahi, it happened, chapter 38, verse 1, at that time, vayered Yehuda meit Achav, that Judah went down from amongst his brothers, vayet ad ish adulei miu shmo Chira, and he strayed to a man from Adulam by the name of Chira. The word vayet appears several times here, and did we talk about this last week? The word vayet, I don't think we did. The word vayet, he strayed. It will happen again as well. Keep in mind the significance of this word. He strayed and went to Chira. Bayar Sham Yehuda Bat Ishkani, so he gets married, and he has three children. And the name of child number one is Er. And what happens? He has a second child, and his name is Onan. He has a third child, his name is Shelah. And he gives a wife to Er Bechoro, and by the name of Tamar. Okay, Vayhi Er Bechor Yehuda. Now notice, by the way, the emphasis on this word, Bechor, firstborn, right? It's a bad sign, right? Vayhi Er, an heir, who, by the way, was his firstborn. He was Rab Enei Hashem. I think we mentioned last week that Er is Ra spelled backwards, right? So Er is bad in the eyes of God. Vayimiteo Hashem, so God killed him. Little does Judah know this is not Tamar's fault, it's not bad luck, but he just dies. Okay, so Judah says to Onan, Bo Eleshet Achicha V'Yabeimotah, come now and consort with the wife of your brother, V'Yabeimotah, perform Yibam with him, and allow your brother's legacy to live. Vayeda Onan ki lo lo yezera, but Onan knew that the child wouldn't be his, and he wasn't interested in surrogate fatherhood, so he made sure that when he was with her, he didn't impregnate her. Vayera b'nei Hashem asher osa. Now God wasn't very pleased with that either. So Er was Rab b'nei Hashem, and this was also Rab b'nei Hashem, bad in the eyes of God. And by the way, same language. Vayera b'nei Hashem, and this was evil in the eyes of God. So now God says he doesn't like him, v'yamet gamoto, so he kills him too. So now Judah is left with Shelah. And Tamar wants to marry Shelah, but Shelah's too young. So Judah says, let's wait a while until Shelah grows up, implying that then Tamar can marry her. Never quite saying it, but implying that. Tamar waits and waits and waits for perhaps a decade. Shelah grows up. And in the meantime, what's happening? Tamar is still mourning over the loss of her husband. She has on her clothes of mourning. And finally, she sees that she's not getting this child. And she has to take desperate action. And that's when she tries to seduce Judah so that some man from this family can marry her and keep alive the legacy of her husband by having a child that will be her husband's child, her dead husband's child. Okay, now I'd like to stop right here for a moment and note a very, very fascinating quirk of God's providence, as it were. Let's look at this very carefully. What does this remind us of? There's a man, and he has three children. The first of the children is evil in the eyes of God. The second child dies because he failed to have enough loyalty towards that first brother. But the first brother that was dead wasn't really dead because he could have been revived. The problem with the second brother is the second brother didn't revive the first brother. And now there's a third brother in which the key for everything exists, but somehow the father can't bring himself to allow that third brother to go to do what he needs to do to be able to get all these brothers back. What does this remind you of? Let's rewind a second and look at Jacob for a moment. That's right, it's Yaakov, right? What happens with Yaakov? Let's play it out. He's got his, quote, firstborn son, just like Judah has his firstborn son. The only problem is it's the wrong firstborn, but we'll leave that off for a moment. So we have Joseph, the firstborn son, right? Okay. Now, that firstborn son gets sold into slavery. Did it ever bother you, by the way, why it was that God allowed it to happen, that this child was almost killed and sold into slavery? The possibility might just be, what was Yosef guilty of? I mean, the Torah uses harsh words to describe Yosef's behavior towards his brothers in the beginning of Vayesha. What does it say? What would he do? Vayavei eti batam ra'ah, there's that word again. He brought back ra tidings, evil tidings, about his brothers. It might just be that in God's view, and certainly in the brothers' view, who was Yosef? At this point, he was ra. I mean, he was just a bad force in the family who's bringing back corrupt words to the father, which just wasn't working out. The brothers were mad about it. So what happens? God allows Yosef to be sold into slavery. Okay. Now, Yosef is not the only son that Jacob loses. Jacob loses another son, too. What other son does he lose? Shimon. When Yosef is king in Egypt, and the brothers come to him for food, Yosef argues that the brothers are slaves and says, I'm going to imprison one of you until you come back with your youngest son, Benjamin. So he takes Shimon to imprison him. You ever wonder why Shimon? I mean, what, they just take him out of a hat? Why Shimon? Okay, so Rashi says because Shimon and Levi were the instigators of the plot. But even if Yosef wouldn't have known that much, what might he have known? First of all, who is Shimon in the pecking order? Where is Shimon? He's number two. Who's above him? Reuven. Now, what was Reuven's role in the sale? He was the guy who was the staunchest ally of Yosef. He was the one, he couldn't bring himself to stop his brothers, but he was going to make an end around and save him. So he was his ally. So who did Yosef choose to imprison? Shimon. The second brother, the oldest brother who was hostile towards Yosef, is the one that is imprisoned. Why is he imprisoned? What does this remind you of? There is a first child, Yosef, and Yaakov loses Yosef. Does he really lose Yosef? No. Yosef is only quasi-dead, right? What about Er? Is Er dead? Yeah, but he's Er. Er means awake. He's living dead. He's only quasi-dead. Why? Because there's the possibility of Yibum. And Yibum can resurrect that marriage and give a son that is going to continue his legacy. So you have two children who are quasi-dead, both of whom maybe are Rab and Hashem and who are taken away. What do you then have? You have a second child, Onan. Why does Onan die? Onan dies because he fails to perform an act of loyalty to save his first brother's legacy. Why does Shimon get thrown into prison? For exactly the same reason. Yosef throws Shimon into prison because he also failed to be loyal and to save him from this fate that awaits him. So brother one is taken away. Brother two is taken away also because he didn't stand up for brother one being taken away. And now what do you have? You have a father who loses two children, the first quasi-dead child and then the second quasi-dead child. And now, where does all hope rest? Well, all hope rests with who? With the third child. Because what happens? Joseph says that you'll get it all, you'll get the food, you'll get whatever you want, but you got to come back with Binyamin. But there's a sad irony here. And what's the sad irony? The sad irony is that Yaakov can't bring himself to part with Binyamin. Why can't Yaakov bring himself to part with Binyamin? Because he says, Yosef einenu, I already lost Yosef, I already lost Shimon. Now you want me to lose Binyamin too? Pen yikra'u ason. Maybe something terrible will happen. By the way, why is it that Yehuda doesn't want to allow Shelah to perform Yibon? He's afraid he's going to die. He says, Pen yamus gam hu ke'echav. Similar language. Lest he die just like his brothers. So both are worried lest something happen to this last remaining brother. So what happens? But the irony of ironies is that Yaakov is shooting himself in the foot. Because if Yaakov could only have enough courage to let Binyamin go, then it's all over. Then he can see Yosef again, because Yosef will reveal himself, and then he'll see Shimon, because Shimon will go out of prison. But he's too scared, he can't let him go. What does this remind you of, folks? Yehuda. Because what Yehuda doesn't realize is that if he just lets Shelah marry Tamar, that there's somebody in disguise. Joseph was in disguise in Egypt. Tamar is in disguise over here. She's Mrs. Harlot. She's the evil lady, right? And she seems like this evil, menacing lady who kills his children, but it's not her fault. And Yosef seems like this evil, menacing visor. It's not. He's just Yosef. What happens is that both are tricked by the outside appearances, and if Yehuda would only recognize that it's not Tamar's fault and would just let Shelah marry Tamar, then everyone can live happily ever after. Then Er is back. Then Onan is back. Then everyone comes back. All the quasi dead people are back. So what happens is, look at the hashgacha here. What God does is he puts Yehuda in exactly the same position that he put his father in. What happened? Yehuda deceived his father about who his firstborn was, and he threw his father into what? An unremitting state of mourning over a child that was only quasi-dead. Because he was only quasi-dead, he wasn't really dead for good, so it was an unremitting state of mourning. And as a result of that, there was a chain reaction. He lost his second son, Shimon. And as a result of that, he could get everything back if he would just let his third son go, but he doesn't have enough courage to let his third son go. So what position are we going to put Yehuda in now? To climb out of this, he's going to have to climb out of exactly the same rut that he put his father in. He too is going to lose a son because he was evil in the eyes of God. And he too is going to lose a second son in a chain reaction because the second son wasn't loyal enough to take his first son out there. And now he's going to be in a position where he's going to have a third son that he too is afraid that lest something happen. But irony of ironies, he doesn't realize that his only chance for salvation for all of these sons is to let her marry the big evil person and let him go see the big evil person that you're afraid is responsible for all of your troubles, but in fact is the only one that you really need in this situation. So he's in exactly the same situation. And by the way, it's a very painful situation for Yehuda. Why? Because if Er was really dead, if there was no possibility of Yibum, you could forget about it. It's finished business. It's over. But there's a problem, which is Er is not really dead. It's unfinished business. And therefore what? The mourning goes on forever. Which reminds you of who? Tamar. Look at Tamar. It's 10 years later. And what does she do when she dresses up like a harlot to go and seduce Judah? She takes off what? Her big day al minuta, her clothes of mourning. She's mourning after 10 years. Yes, everyone's mourning after 10 years because he's a quasi-dead child. He's not really dead. You can't get over a quasi-dead child. Yaakov mourned for his quasi-dead son, he said, until he dies. And here too, as long as Yibum is a possibility, everyone's going to mourn for Er until somehow you can finish the unfinished business. And this story is about, can you finish the unfinished business? Okay. Now, what happens next? Let's continue reading the story. Tamar decides that it's dress-up time. So she takes off her clothes in mourning, and she dresses up as if she is a harlot, right? Okay. And now we have the second Vayet. What happens? She dresses up as a harlot and seduces him. Vayet elea el aderech. Now this is strange. If there's a road here, if someone strays, do they stray from the road or to the road? From the road. But look at this verse. Vayet elea el haderech. He strays to her to the road. What do you mean you stray to her to the road? And by the way, look where she was. Look at the verse before, verse 14. When she puts on these clothes, but where does she decide to sit? At the crossroads. But look at the Hebrew. Vateshev bepetach einayim, which could mean crossroads, but could mean something else too. What does petach einayim really mean? With open eyes. She sits with open eyes. She is disguised, but her eyes are open. And where does she sit? She sits on the crossroads to lure who? Judah. Now, who is Judah? What does it mean that Tamar sits with open eyes? Because Tamar might be disguising herself, but she knows exactly what she's doing, and she's acting for noble purposes. She may be dressed up like a harlot, but what she's doing is she's trying to act with loyalty towards her deceased husband is to make sure that his progeny can survive in the only way that it can. She knows that if she levels with Judah, Judah will never marry her. She knows that this is the only possible way to be able to be loyal and true to Er's memory. So she seduces him with open eyes. What about Judah? If Tamar has open eyes, who has closed eyes? Judah. Judah doesn't realize what's going on. He's completely in the dark. He is blind in this situation. Right. So what do you do in this situation? What do you do? So Vayet Elea, so Judah strays. He strays again. But where does he stray to? To her. And where is she? She's on the road. Normally when you stray from the path. Who strays to the path? Someone who's already off the path. If you're already off the path, then where do you stray? You stray to the path. That's Judah. Judah's off the path. He just doesn't recognize what, I mean, he's lost his way, right? Where is Tamar? Tamar is on the path. Now, it looks to Judah as if he's straying because he's consorting with his harlot. Judah doesn't realize that he's not straying, that he's straying. Yes, he's straying, but where is he straying? He's straying back to the path. How do you make a blind person sighted? You blind them more, right? If you notice, Judah is blind. If you trick him as to what his sight is, you can lead him back to where he really needs to go. Where he needs to go is to be with Tamar, and she leads him there the only way she can. She sits with open eyes, and she leads him back to stray to the path. Okay, so he consorts with her. And then we get this very strange situation where the Torah bothers to tell us about these intimate details of the bargaining session between Judah and this harlot. And you got to ask yourself, why is the Torah, where every word is supposed to be precious, interested in giving us details that we would only expect to appear in the National Enquirer? I mean, why do we have to hear that, oh, well, what are you going to give me? I'll give you this, I'll give you that. But the Torah is trying to tell us something very deep in this bargaining session. Let's listen very carefully to it. Matiten li kitavo elai. What are you going to give me in return for this act, Tamar says. Vayomer, and he says, Anochi ashalach kadi izi minatzon. He says, oh, no problem. I'm going to give you a goat. The only problem is, I don't have one here. So we talked about this last week. Why doesn't Judah have the goat? Because it's dead, right? Because the goat was killed when you slaughtered it to put the blood on Joseph's coat. So there's no goat. So now he has to come up with a goat replacement. So what does he do? She says, I'm not going to allow you to get off with this and trust you with this goat. I need some sort of eravon. I need some sort of collateral. So what eravon are you going to give me? So Vayomer Mahe Ravona Sharetim Lofsi says, well, what can I possibly give you as collateral? But Tamar, she says, Chotam Cho Ptilcho Matcha, oh, I'll take your signet ring, I'll take your cloak, and I'll take your staff. Those will be fine as collateral. And Vayitin La, and he gives to her. What is the identity of this collateral? A cloak, a staff, and a signet ring. Who wears cloaks, staffs, and signet rings? Kings. What is he doing by giving that away as collateral? He's giving away his kingship. Okay? In that act, he is entrusting his kingship to her. The story of Judah and Tamar is Judah giving away what he already lost the moral right to have in the last story. He lost the right to leave, and now he's formally giving away his implements of kingship. And now, you would say it's over. But it's not over. Because an eravon is not given for keeps. Collateral is still mine. It's just in her domain. The question of Judah and Tamar and the tension of Judah and Tamar is, can Judah get back this collateral or not? Is there a way that he can retrieve these tools of kingship? That is what the story of Judah and Tamar is about. Now, if you look about how he lost the tools of kingship, let's talk about that for just a moment. How did Judah lose the tools of kingship? Listen carefully to what he did. Here's what Judah did. He had a situation. Two of his kids were dead. He had his last remaining child. Tamar comes to him and says, I want to marry Shelah, the only way that I can have this child. Judah has a choice. What's his choice? Judah's worried. Let's say he's not going to give it to her because he's worried. He's too scared. He has a choice. What can he do? Choice A, he can put her off. I don't know, we'll see, you know, Shelah's still pretty young. Why don't we talk about it when Shelah gets 10 years from now, when Shelah gets older? Never having an intention to give him to her. That's one thing you can do. Or what's the other more painful thing you can do? You can say no. You can make the hard choice and just say, look, I'm really worried about this. I know it's a good idea, but we're just not doing this. Go on and live your life. But he doesn't do that. What does this remind you of? When you see the reality in front of you, but it's painful to take that step and to just say no, so you don't stop it and you allow something to fester and just get worse. It's exactly what he did before. In not telling Tamar no, in not stopping it and not putting his foot down, what he is really doing is repeating his mistake. In the sale of Joseph, he failed to stop a mistake in its infancy when he could have, and the mistake just got worse. He failed to take his moral clarity and say, it's wrong, we have to stop it, come what may, let's bring this child back to his father. Here, too, he fails to say, I can't do it, I'm sorry. Instead, he puts it off. He says, well, let's wait for later. That is a failure of leadership, and it gets him again into a position where his only choice is to give her an eravon. He doesn't have the goat anymore. If he had the goat, he wouldn't have to give away his tools of kingship. If he only had that goat and hadn't killed it in sacrifice, sacrifice to give away Joseph, his rival brother, he wouldn't be in a position of having to give away his staff and his signet ring. But he doesn't have the goat. The goat is dead. And now the only thing he can do is to give those things away. And now the question is, can he get them back? Now, he has a first possibility of getting them back. What's his first attempt to get them back? Remember what happens? The first attempt to do it is he finally gets his hand on a goat. So what does he do? He accosts his friend, Mr. Adulemi, Mr. Chira, and he says, "Would you please go and find the harlot?" Only there's a problem. There's no harlot, right? So he goes and he tries to, and here we have all the finding, which we talked about last week. So he goes and tries to find the harlot. No harlot. Comes back and says, "I tried to find her. She's not there. No found harlot." So Judah then has a choice. Again, his third choice in all of these stories now confronts him. Here's the story. You promised this woman a goat. You gave her something to make good on your promise that you're going to give her a goat. You sent somebody to look for her, and they can't find her, and they asked around for her. Now you have a choice. He comes back and says, "What should we do? What can you do? What are your two options?" Option number one is, keep looking, right? I mean, you did promise her a goat. If you wanted to, you could keep looking and try to discover their identity and find her. But that's not what he chooses to do. What does he choose to do instead? Let's listen carefully to what he says. Vayomer Yehuda. Yehuda says, Tikachla. Let her just keep the collateral already. Pen niya lavuz, lest it come to scandal. Hine shalachti agdia zeh. Look, I sent this goat, va'ata lomitzata, and you didn't find her. So what am I supposed to do? What does this remind you of? It's the same thing all over again. You see a mistake. The moral choice is clear in front of you. Do you take the hard road or you take the easy road? The hard road is that you keep on looking. People will ask. You have a moral obligation to give it to her. This is what you promised. You got to keep on looking, right? But he doesn't do that. What's he worried about? He's worried about scandal. People are going to wonder, how come Judah's asking for harlots, right? So he says, look, let her just keep it already. And then he rationalizes it. I tried, you know, I looked already, so, you know, I tried. Now, what is happening here? What is happening is something momentous. Because if he lets her keep that collateral, and it's no longer collateral, but it's hers now, what does that mean for the Davidic dynasty? It's all gone. There's no such thing as kings from Judah anymore. Judah is no longer king. That fragile bond linking him and his collateral is about to be severed. If she keeps those things in a third and final failure of leadership on the part of Judah, it means that Judah cannot rebound. He is not going to be king anymore. He doesn't realize the consequences of what he's about to do. What?
The children will be his children.
But now what's going to happen? What's going to happen, the irony of ironies, is that the thing that Judah's been looking for all along, he's looking for the harlot, he's looking for the harlot, he's looking for the harlot, there's that word, matzah, 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 all of a sudden changes it to something else. Judah's informed that Tamar is pregnant. Hotziua vatitzareif, he mutzait. Now the word matzah doesn't mean find anymore, it means its opposite, it means take out. What's he doing? He was looking to find something. Well, who was he looking for? He was looking for the harlot. Little did he realize that the harlot was right under his nose the whole time. It was Tamar. And you know who he was really looking for? On a deeper level, who was he looking for more than the harlot? Who is Judah really looking for in this story? Judah's looking for heir. He's looking for his child. And where is heir? In her womb. That's where heir is, right? That heir is awake and can come back. And that's and what he was looking for all along is right under his nose. It's Tamar. But what's he doing now? Hotziu avatisaref. Throw her out. Take what I found and throw her out and kill her. And if he does throw her out and kill her, what happens to that little precious child in the womb? What happens to Peretz? What happens to the father of Boaz? What happens to the father of Jesse? What happens to the father of David? What happens to the father of Solomon? It's all gone. And it's gone because of what? Because of Judah, because Judah killed her. So what's about to happen is he's literally signing away his entire kingship by taking that which is under his nose and throwing it out in a wicked twist of fate. This is a perfect payback for what he did to his own father. What did he say when he uses those words matzah to his father? Zot matzanu, this is what we found. We found this coat, but it was a lie because the coat didn't represent what the coat looked to represent. There was something deeper beyond the coat, which Jacob was really looking to find. And what was that? The person in the coat. It was Joseph. And by presenting the outer shell of the coat, what he was really saying is what's inside the coat is not found but lost. It's a game of lost and found. That's taken out. He's not there anymore. He's dead. But actually, he was very righteous. He didn't say that, right? It was like a white lie. He never actually said that Joseph was dead. He just said, we found this. What do you think of this? And Jacob had to draw his own conclusions. And the tragedy of those conclusions were that he came to the wrong conclusions, that he got fooled by the outside thing that was found and didn't realize that what was inside was really lost when it oughtn't to have been lost at all. And now look at this wicked irony, that one more time Judah himself is confronted with these own words. He's trying to find something. He's trying to find Tamar. He's trying to find this harlot. He's looking, but he doesn't realize that there's an outer shell encompassing something inner. The outer shell is the harlot, but that's not who she is. She's really Tamar, and she has this child inside of her, and what he's looking for is really beneath that. But he himself then goes and takes her out and throws her out, because he doesn't realize who she is, so she takes her and he throws him out, not realizing that he's throwing out the core. He's throwing out what really means the most to him. But the story isn't over, because Tamar has something in her possession. She has the Eravon. And as she's been taken out to be burned, in a great act of heroism, she sends that back to him. Now that's a great act of heroism, because if you were Tamar and you wanted to save your life, what would you do? One call to the inquirer is all it takes. I mean, you've got his stuff, right? You have the coat. You have all the evidence. I mean, you're in the driver's seat, but she doesn't do that. Listen to that heroism. What she does is she takes this and she gives away all her power. She gives it right back to him. What can he do now? What can this man do if he wants to? He can deny it. He can cover it all up. He's about to see the truth. He's about to see what's morally right to do. And he's got one more chance. This is the great test of kingship. Can you see what's morally right to do and take the terrible plunge and do what's right? Well, if pattern has been any key, this is a very dangerous thing that she's doing, because if he wants, he can cover it up. No one would ever know the difference if he killed her and buried the stuff, right? And this is the last chance. And now what does she do? She's being taken away. He mutzait. And she says one more time, Hakerna. The same words that Judah said to his father, Hakerna, do you recognize the coat? She now presents a coat to him and uses those same words and says, can you redeem that first Hakerna? Do you recognize the coat? And now he's faced for the fourth time with that terrible challenge. Will he cover it up or will he bite the bullet? And the stakes are much higher now. Because remember, Judah didn't want to keep searching for the harlot because it's going to come to scandal. Now look what he's going to have to do. He has just condemned this woman to death for adultery. He's now going to have to bring her back from the firing line. And listen to what he says, and this is his great heroism. What he does, he looks at the coat, and he does not cover it up. Vayakira. He answers affirmatively to the, do you recognize this? He recognizes it, and he says, Vayakira, and he says, Tzotkami meni, she is more righteous than I, ki al kein lo natatiya l'sheila b'ni, because I didn't give her to Sheila, and she was just looking to perpetuate the memory of her dead husband. I acted out of lust, and she acted out of nobility. Look how difficult this is to do. This man is the judge. He just condemned this woman to death. He's Mr. Judge. He now has to change the whole thing around. No, she's the righteous one. She's much more righteous than I. I was the one who was intimate. I was going to kill her for adultery, but I was the one who was intimate with her, with this woman that I was going to kill. And she acted nobly and I didn't, right? It's a great act of moral courage. And with it, he gets back the Eravon. He gets back his implements of kingship. And he doesn't just get back the Eravon. He gets back Er. And he gets back Er. He gets back that child. And that child is not burned to death. That child is born. And when that child is born, and the child is who? The child is Peretz and Zerach, and Peretz is going to be the ancestor of the dynasty. And listen to one other beautiful thing that happens in the wake of this redemption. As Peretz is born, listen to the words. As she was giving birth, there were twins in her womb. What does this remind you of? What? Yaakov and Esav. It reminds you of Yaakov and Esav. It's the same language, right? Vayhi belidatan, as she was giving birth, vayiten yad, vatika chamyaledet, there was one child is coming out of the womb and putting out his hand, and the nursemaid takes it, vatikshur yado shani, and places a red string on that hand to say, ze yatzar rishono, this is the real bechor. Here is the real bechor, right? And then what happens? Vayhi kameshiv yado, the child draws his hand back, vihine yatza achiv, and the brother comes out first. Vatomer, and he says to her, Ma paratza alecha peretz? Look at you, you explosive little child. How did you explode out before the other one? And that is Peretz. What does this remind you of? Yaakov and Esav. Where did Yaakov come out? Why was Yaakov named Yaakov? Because his hand was also doing something. What was his hand doing? Holding on to the ankle of his other brother. But who actually came out first? Esav. But who comes out first here? Peretz. Peretz wins where Yaakov failed. Yaakov, his whole life, had tried to be the firstborn, had tried to be grasping onto the heel of Esav, but never quite succeeded and resorted to deception. And that deception led to further deception, caused a terrible cascade of deception, where the brothers felt in such terrible pain because the father put them in the same situation and raised one as the Bechor over the others. And the family comes to final disillusion over this, and it leads to Yehud and Tamar. But the first glimmer of redemption happens when Yehuda can start to put the pieces back. When Yehuda looks Tamar in the eye and starts to redeem that first hakerna, starts to redeem that trickery, then there's the first glimpses of healing in the chain of hakara begin to happen. The first deception of the father of Yaakov to Esav that started this chain happened with the words Hakara, and now those fateful words have come back and are finally being healed. When Yaakov is able to, when Yehuda is able to say, to answer affirmatively to her Hakerna, the child that is born is able to succeed where Yaakov himself had failed. He's able almost to rectify not just his own mistakes, but the mistakes and the legacy of his family. Now there's a child that can be born, that can legitimately come first, that doesn't just hold on to the heel, but is able to pull himself out for good.
And that's the very essence of his name.
And the very essence of his name is, that's right, and the essence of Yaakov's name is Yaakov, heel, and the essence of Peretz's name is Peretz, to explode out, not to just be always grasping the heel, but being able to legitimately be the firstborn because you came out first and you don't need to trick anybody anymore. I want to conclude with the following thing. What is happening here is the following. Yehuda is redeeming his kingship. As we stated before, Yehuda's kingship was flawed in two ways. It was flawed in way number one, in that he failed to correct a fault when he could have, when he saw it and could have corrected it. It was faulted in way number two, in that he was a leader for only part of the clique of his brothers, for one clique and not for the whole clique. There's a little bit of a deeper aspect to both of these actions, which I want to dwell on here, and with this I will let you go. Let's focus on the first failure of leadership, the inability to correct a fault when it was done. Where does he correct that? When he's finally able to stand up to the recognition to answer affirmatively, I recognize what's going on. That recognition is a very, very deep act of redemption. It's a deep act of redemption because what does he have to do it? How did Yehuda get his name? Leah called him Yehuda because Hapam Odet Hashem, this time I will thank God. Okay? This time I will thank God. His name means thanks. His name actually comes from the word hoda'a, which means three different things. It means thanks, it means praise, it means admission. Why do we have one word that means three things? The power of hoda'a is a very fascinating power. It is actually the power of kingship. For Yehuda to be king means that he is someone who has hoda'a. Hoda'a lies at the essence of kingship. To be king means to thank, to praise, and admit. What does it mean to thank, to praise, and admit? What's the essence of the... By the way, Abraham Tversky argues it's only three words you need to have a successful marriage. Only three words you need to know. It's thank you, I'm sorry, and I admire you. You know, those three words, you're fine, right? Interestingly, those are the three faces of Hoda'a. What is Hoda'a? Hoda'a is those three things. It's all one thing. If you have one Hebrew word that means three things in English, it's because they aren't really three things. They're one thing. Praise, thanks, and admission is really one thing. What are they? If I had more time, I'd spend a half an hour just on this, but I don't. So I'm just going to tell you. What is the common denominator of all these three things? What it is the following. Human relationships can get out of balance. If I do you a favor, our relationship is out of balance. You owe me. If I do something terrible to you, our relationship is out of balance. Now, right, I owe you. If I do something terrible to you, so then what do you want to do? You want to reciprocate. You want to take revenge. What do you want to do if I do you a favor? You want to reciprocate. You want to give back to me. Why? You're seeking balance. You want to come back into balance. But what if you can't reciprocate? What if I've done you a great favor you can never repay? Or what if I've done a terrible thing to you and you don't want to take revenge? So you live in this state of imbalance and it's very uncomfortable. How do you get out of the imbalance? You get out of it through an act of hoda'a. What hoda'a is, it's the capacity to restore balance in relationships without reciprocation. What do I do when I say thank you? What do the words thank you even mean in English? A synonym for thank you is I appreciate it. What does appreciate mean? It means to recognize the value of something. If I look you in the eye and say, I recognize the value of what you have done, it's the same thing as saying thank you. Think about how ironic this is. And by the way, how do I say I'm sorry? It's the same thing. I look you in the eye and recognize the meaning of what I've done. If I look you in the eye and say, I know what I've done and how painful it was to you, and I get it, and you understand that I get it, then there can be forgiveness. What has happened in this act of recognition? What has happened is something tremendously powerful but paradoxical, which is that the reason why we avoid, why it's so hard to say thank you and why it's so hard to admit you're wrong, is because you're looking the imbalance in the eye. What could be worse than admitting there's an imbalance there? Then the imbalance will just grow, right? I asked a kid once, how do you say I'm sorry without saying I'm sorry? Do you know what he answered? He said, I didn't mean to do it. That's not how you say I'm sorry. That's how you don't recognize it. To say I'm sorry is to really recognize what it is that you've done. If you do that, magically the imbalance goes away. It makes no sense, but it's true. If you look the imbalance in the eye and the other person recognizes that, the imbalance can go away. At its core, the act of hodah is three things: thanks, praise, and admission that is really one. If there is one word to symbolize thanks, praise, and admission, what is it? It is haker. It is recognition. The core of what Judah's name is all about is recognition. When she says, Hakerna, do you recognize this? What she's really asking him to do is, can you live up to your name? Who are you? And when he recognizes that cloak, he's not recognizing just the cloak. He's doing a much more profound act of recognition too. Because look what he says to her. He says to her, do you know what? Sadka mimeni. She is more righteous than I. Because I acted in lust and she acted nobly. That is the greatest act of hodah that you can imagine. The definition of hodah is, I can look you in the eye and recognize that you are up there and I am down here. And that's exactly what Yehuda is able to do. He looks her in the eye and says, to everyone else it seems like I'm Mr. Judge and you're the faithless harlot. But in fact, it's not true. The opposite is the reverse. You are more righteous than I. You're up there and I'm down here and I can recognize that. And that is an act of hodah. Yehuda, who is named for Hodah, now makes a great act of Hodah through Hakara, through this recognition, and begins to redeem himself. It's the beginning of his redemption. And finally, one last piece, the Eravon. There was an Eravon given here, and there's another Eravon that we meet again. When is the next time we have an Eravon? The next time we have an Eravon is, remember, when Jacob will not send Binyamin back. Now remember, this is the key point in the story. This is the point where Jacob has already lost two sons and can't bear to part with the last one. Irony of ironies, where does Jacob get the strength to part from Benjamin? Reuven tries to give it to him. Reuven tries to do it but fails. Once again, Reuven doesn't succeed as a leader. What does Reuven say? Et shnei banai tamit. I'll kill my two sons. It's an illegitimate statutory use of power. You can't. That's not leadership. That's not going to convince me of anything. You'll kill your two sons. I don't want that, right? It's using the nuclear option. It's like saying what nuclear deterrence is about is blowing the other guy up. It's not. It's about not blowing the other guy up. It's about having it in reserve, right? I'll kill my two sons. That doesn't convince me of anything. I'll kill my own two sons. By the way, listen to the irony. I'll kill my own two sons. Who has lost two sons? Jacob has lost two sons. Shimon and Yosef. And who else has lost two sons? Yehuda has lost Aaron Onan. And now the man who has really lost two sons speaks to the other man who has really lost two sons, Yaakov, and says to him, you know what I'm going to promise? Nothing more than myself. Nothing else. Anochi e'ervenu, I will be the collateral. Miyadi tivakshenu, you can always come back to me for this. Im lo avienu elecha, if I don't bring this child back to you, you know what the consequences will be? Nothing. But, v'chatati lecha kol hayamim, if I don't bring him back, I will have sinned against you forevermore. And you can take that with you to the grave. What he's saying to him is, that, and this is another great act of leadership, but what is he doing? He's saying he understands what it means to pledge yourself as collateral. Why? Because he'd once redeemed collateral. What does it mean to redeem collateral? What is collateral? Collateral is something which at times you'd rather forget about. It makes you responsible for something you don't want to be responsible for. To redeem it is to redeem something which I don't want to be responsible for, which I would rather leave in someone else's hands if I could, but there's a debt that I have to pay. And now he's able not just to redeem and pledge something else as collateral, but he himself will be the collateral. And who is he collateral for Benjamin? And whose child is Benjamin? Rachel, the brother of Yosef. Once I sold a child of this woman into slavery, and I destroyed my leadership by showing that I was the leader only of a clique, but now I will be responsible. I once redeemed the collateral. I once was able to rebuild the seeds of leadership by taking responsibility for something I didn't want to take responsibility for with Tamar. Now I will bring that back into my relationship with Yosef. And what am I going to do? I'm going to pledge myself as collateral. Me, myself as collateral for who? For the child, for the brother of the child that I sold into slavery, for the rival wife. I'm the child of Leah. I'm in so much pain because Yaakov made my wife less than his wife, and now I'm going to pledge myself as collateral for this child. In doing so, he really begins to heal his kingship in a stronger way too. He has now shown that he is not just the leader of a clique, but he's a leader of the whole people, even the children of the rival mother. And by doing so, what does he do? He not only redeems himself in giving himself the ability to patch up a character flaw in his kingship, but he redeems himself another way too. He redeems a consequence of his sin. Because in selling Yosef, what had he done? He had plunged his father into an unremitting state of mourning from which the father had a terribly difficult time extricating himself because he couldn't bear to part with his last son. And if only he could part with his last son, the nightmare could be over, but he can't do it. So what does Yehuda do, the man who was able to climb out of that hole once before? He says, Dad, you can't part with your last child because of the situation I put you in. Let me help you part with him. I will be the collateral. And when he's able to say that, what he's able to do is to give him is to give Yaakov the strength to be able to part with this child, to be able to dig Yaakov out of the hole that he put him in. You don't have that strength, but I can have the strength for you. I will be the collateral. And finally, Yosef reveals himself. But when does Yosef reveal himself? When does Yosef decide the jig is up? He decides the jig is up when Yehuda stands before him and he redeems that collateral. When Yehuda is able to look him in the eye and say, do you know what? I can't bear to go back to my father and to say that I'm not coming back with Benjamin. He says, my father's soul is tied up with Benjamin. I can't go back and say that he's dead. Who is Benjamin? The child of Rachel. Do you know the heroism of Yehuda to be able to say that? What Yehuda is saying is that you loved Rachel more than you loved my mother, and that you are so tied in with the children of Rachel that my father is going to go down to his grave crying if I do this to him one more time and I let you come back without Benjamin. I can't do that to him. And therefore, I am willing to admit that my father loves this person more than me. And I will go into slavery now rather than allow another child of Rachel's to be in slavery. When he does that, he fully redeems himself in this area of kingship, and he is able to truly show that he is a leader of all the people, even the people that he doesn't want to leave, or that he would rather not leave, that he could turn back from. And it's then that Yosef reveals himself and says, now you can be king, and now I can step down. That's it, folks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Awesome. What did you say about Yitzhak?
This is the end of tape 5. The series continues at this point on tape 6.